Greetings, everyone. This is the fifth of a series of six talks that I'm giving on the book I edited, The Light That Shines Through Infinity, Zen and the Energy of Life, by our founder, Katagiri Roshi. This talk is about part four of the book, Wisdom and Compassion. Katagiri Roshi was asked in an interview for a magazine to say what Buddhism is. In other words, is it a religion, a philosophy, an activity, or what? He said it was a way of life based on wisdom and compassion. It's a very simple answer, and we intuitively understand what it means. But it's also a very deep answer that stands for the way that Buddhism understands life itself. In terms of Buddhist philosophy, wisdom stands for emptiness and impermanence. Compassion stands for oneness and interdependence. A Buddhist way of life naturally arises from seeing those principles at work in your own life. In this book, Katagiri also says, in Buddhism, wisdom and compassion is a term for love. Not the usual sense of love, but the very serious and also very soft basis of human existence from which you can take a deep breath, breathing like the wind blows, breathing naturally on the grass in the field. The serious basis of love is awareness that this moment will never come again. But the effect of what we do in it doesn't go away. It becomes a cause for the future. So we want to live carefully and protect what we love. The soft basis of love is having a humble and open heart that trusts in the people around us. There are two themes that show up in part four that have stayed with me and guided me since I first met them. So those are the two things I want to talk about today. Those two things are the sadness in compassion and basking in Buddha's compassion. After that, I'm going to offer you Katagiri Roshi's simple mindfulness practice for everyday life that is based on wisdom and compassion. So, the sadness and compassion. Katagiri Roshi says that compassion consists of two terms, kindness, which is maitri in Sanskrit, or metta in Pali, and sadness, which is karuna. In Japanese, the word for compassion is jihi, where ji is the character for the desire to give happiness to all beings, and hi is the character for sadness. Katagiri said, ever since I became a monk, I wanted to know why there is sadness and compassion instead of just kindness. I didn't understand it. Finally, I learned that to understand it, you have to taste that sadness. To understand that sadness, we have to start with wisdom, because compassion arises from wisdom. Wisdom is the experience of realizing that the original nature of your own existence is emptiness. The spacious and peaceful state of being in which all life coexists without discrimination. Realizing that the self is empty sounds nihilistic, but in the experience of emptiness, there remains a subtle level of awareness, and that awareness understands emptiness as a sublime state of relief and freedom that is a human birthright and our original home. Wisdom experiences that spaciousness, but wisdom also observes the human consciousness, which is subtly functioning on the surface of emptiness. It's attempting to build walls and establish separation where oneness and openness could be. The result of that separation, which consciousness eventually does establish, is our original suffering called dukkha, which we know from studying Buddha's Four Noble Truths. We call it suffering or dissatisfaction, but naming it doesn't touch the profound sense of loss, grief, and longing we carry just from having a body and mind that hides our original nature from us and tells us we're alone and vulnerable. Katagiri calls it the deep moan that is present in everyone's life, a deep and limitless moan that is beyond words, coming from the bottom of your life. It's really the source of our spiritual quest and longing to find what's missing in our life. We follow a spiritual practice so we can recover our basic sense of belonging to life. We can experience recovering it, but for most human beings, that experience doesn't permanently free us from suffering. What it does is show us what the foundation of suffering is, where it comes from, and how to accept it and work with it. Then, when you see that suffering in others, you recognize it and can respond to it from a deep spirit of togetherness. Sometimes I see compassion explained as putting others before yourself. But for me, it works better to say it's seeing yourself in others. Compassion as kindness arises from recognizing that everyone and everything has the same deep suffering that you have, and then opening your heart and expressing oneness with others in a tender way. Avalokiteshvara is the bodhisattva of compassion that you see represented in statues of a person with many, many arms radiating out from the body. We know Avalokiteshvara from the Heart Sutra, where he practices the perfection of wisdom and describes emptiness to Shariputra. Avalokiteshvara becomes the bodhisattva of compassion by allowing his or her original nature to soften the divisions between self and other, and then listening to the cries of the world and reaching out to relieve that suffering with 1,000 hands of kindness. I think this is what the Dalai Lama practices when he says his religion is kindness. Opening your heart and sharing your life with someone can relieve their suffering and also your own suffering. In that case, you save each other because you are no longer completely separate. Your life and others' life are just one interconnected life. You can also offer compassion to yourself by bringing forth an awareness of your bigger, open self and letting it listen to your small self. Let it see your everyday sufferings of fear, injustice, loss, and trauma of all kinds, and offer a feeling of safety and belonging to that small self. This teaching on suffering and compassion has been very helpful to me personally. It encourages me to not look away from the deep sadness of life, but to accept it and value it as something real and true. It's helped me to be more honest with myself about why I made certain choices the way I did, and eventually to rewrite the story I tell myself about how events unfolded in my life. The next theme is basking in Buddha's compassion. I put a quote for this on the printed program, so I'll read it. When you reach the bottom of your life and see the ultimate nature of being, you realize there is nothing there. Well, there is only one thing there, motion. That movement is the basic nature of being, the rhythm of life itself. The movement of nothingness gives you a certain kind of energy. It shoots up from the basic nature of being, and you receive it as the energy of your own life. That is enlightenment, we say. But strictly speaking, it is Buddha's compassion. It is the great compassion you already possess. I wanted to include more there, but there wasn't room to print everything. So let me just say the rest of what follows after this. He said, Buddha's compassion is very deep in your life. It is the form of your own life. Your body and mind are produced by compassion. Your life, the life of everything you see, and everything you hear, are nothing but the total manifestation of Buddha's warm, compassionate heart. So whatever you may feel, whatever you may think, whatever you may do, Buddha's compassion is there. You cannot see it, but your life, everyone's life, is constantly supported by Buddha's compassion. When you trust in Buddha's compassion, this is called faith. So I think the appearance of the word faith here is kind of a surprise for us. It seems to come from some other religion where we might be told to just accept something on faith. But that's not what's going on here. Buddhism doesn't do that. Buddhist faith is a way of looking at the human world in a certain way, based on the way we would naturally experience it if our minds weren't covered by the veil of ignorance. That way of looking comes from understanding that your life never really leaves emptiness. That original energy is always within you and the life around you, so you can depend on it. Even in troubled times, you can find peace. Emptiness is sometimes called the Great Mother, or the womb of Buddha, because it gives birth to the world of phenomenon. The creative energy of life is embodied in each of us. You are a child of Buddha. That means we deserve to exist. We can relax and accept ourselves. Rest and bask in the experience of receiving Buddha, Mother Buddha's love as the energy of our lives. If you calm down in Zazen, you can viscerally experience that energy rising in your body. Maybe this mother stuff doesn't work for you, but for me it's been really important. I get a feeling of being okay from it. I somehow didn't get that feeling from my own mother. She loved me and she took care of me, but she was very strict and critical and definitely not a hugger. So I really take a lot of comfort in this understanding that my life is supported by something that represents love to me. So now I want to talk about an everyday practice that Katagiri taught that we can do to express compassion in the world around us with the things that we see and touch every day. It's called Kano Doko. It's a mindfulness practice that I use pretty often. It helps me to slow down and deal with my anxiety and feel more grounded and in tune with myself. I think it's related to the formal practice style of Soto Zen, our practice, which is called Menmitsu. Our lineage is sometimes called Menmitsu no Kafu, which is a very careful and considerate style. It's called that because that's the defining character or flavor of the Soto lineage. It's something that distinguishes Soto Zen practice from Rinzai Zen, which is said to take a rougher and noisier approach. Menmitsu is a way of behaving characterized by concentrating on paying soft, loving attention to the details of one's behavior and doing things with a sense of calm, dignity, and ceremony. It can be described as continuous intimacy, soft subtleness, and warm-hearted, thorough diligence. Just seeing someone who behaves like that has a way of calming your mind. Katagiri brought it here from Japan and made it part of our practice, but its roots go back to China. Kano Doko is a version of that practice style that's suited to everyday life. It's immediately enjoyable in its own right, and it's also a training in the habit of relaxing and opening our hearts to others. I planned to talk about Kano Doko in my own words, but as it turns out, I'm going to give you Katagiri Roshi's words for it, which some of you will recognize from reading the book. When you cook a meal, a vegetable is separate from you. You are you, and the vegetable is the vegetable. But on the other hand, all sentient beings are supported by the lively energy of life. The great energy that supports your life also supports the vegetable's life. So the vegetable and you are interconnected. If you open yourself to the vegetable, you can get into the vegetable's life, and the vegetable can come into your life. Then you and the vegetable can communicate. When you see the vegetable as an expression of the universal energy in hearing and everything, there is a kind of inspiration that goes in and out between you and the universe. That spiritual communion is called Kano Doko. Kan means receive or feel. No is respond. Do is path or the way. Ko is crossing. You cannot explain it, but you feel good. Immediately you feel what you really are. Then, when you look at a vegetable, you see many beings in the realm of the vegetable's life. That is the real life of the vegetable, Buddha's life, we say. In the realm of time, you cannot see the energy inhering in the vegetable directly, but still you can take care of it in a concrete way. How? Very simple. Deal with a vegetable with warm-heartedness, expressing the lively energy of your life and respecting the lively energy the vegetable also possesses. Accept that a vegetable is Buddha, then open yourself and extend your life toward the vegetable's life. Just walk with it. Very naturally, you handle the vegetable with compassionate attention. This is very simple Zen practice. If you think of this practice with the frontal lobe of human knowledge, you don't believe it, because human knowledge cannot see the panoramic picture of one life working with the universal life of all sentient beings. So relax your frontal lobe and just take care of your daily living. Even if you don't understand Zen teaching intellectually, still you can pay kind, compassionate attention to the things around you. Pay attention to others, not just yourself. This is the practice of egolessness. It is a practical way to live every day. Sooner or later, you will taste the lively energy of life. I have another short one that I think from the book that I think I have time to read. The peace of mindfulness is the state of settling the small self in the big self. You can aim at this target every day in whatever you do. For example, the moment when you open a door is your time and opportunity to tune in to the rhythm of the life of the door. So when you encounter a door that you must pass through, don't see the door with your limited understanding and open the door carelessly. Open yourself to the door first, then open the door. Pass through and close the door, but not with a bang. Close the door with careful attention. Don't be in a rush. This is the practice of having few desires. By opening yourself to a door, you can realize the true quality of practicing few desires because satisfaction appears. And you enjoy serenity and tranquility. Tranquility enables you to handle the door very quietly, and by this quiet action, you create a harmonious mood between the door and you. When you deal with a door like this, you hit the bullseye of the door with one stroke and become you as you really are. This you is not the self you understand egotistically. This you is not you. Not you is you who has merged with the door. At that time, you experience peaceful communion with the door. You are there, but you are not only you, you are also the door. So are you, you are you and also not you, because you are you and the door. That's really what I have for you today. I spent a lot of time leading up to this thinking about what to say about wisdom and compassion. I kept searching for engaging ways to illustrate it or examples of how it can help us cope with the stressful times we're living in. But it kept slipping away from me and nothing seemed to fit my heart. That kind of surprised me because this is a wonderful part of the book. Chapter 15, which is called Directing Your Boat, is especially important because it comes from the last series of talks that Katagiri gave on preparing to receive the Bodhisattva precepts and joining the Buddhist lineage through lay ordination. I really recommend reading that. In the end, all I can say is that in human affairs, hard times are inevitable. They make it even more important to try to look at things from the deepest level of insight you have and to see things from the broadest view of humanity and history that you can muster. As Buddhists, we just try to understand the causes and conditions that produce difficult situations. And we try not to hurt others or feel superior to others while we're responding to those situations. So my talk next month will be my final talk. and it's going to be on part 5, Peace and Harmony. I would really enjoy it if some of the time next month could be spent in a group discussion about any aspect of the book or Katagiri Roshi's teaching that interests you. So if you have thoughts or questions, please bring them along next month. Okay, so thank you. Hi, Guy.
Now, you probably remember that in the 1980s when Katagiri was here, wherever you went, there was a little 3x5 card. It had a little, you washed your hands, you flushed the toilet, remember?
Yeah.
People, and there was a little saying like that to teach his way of life.
Right, there were little gathas that were... mindfulness is a word that you hear so much now. It's hard to know just from hearing the word what the person is trying to represent to you. Mindfulness in Buddhism, in our way of understanding Buddhism, I'll say, has a really kind of a deep flavor to it. That's more like concentration, more like bringing your mind into focus on doing one particular thing as a way of practice, like we might focus on our breath or posture in Zazen. It's really a way of going deep. So it's a way of trying to go deep into the one mind that everyone shares.
Sadness, and is it the same as suffering?
No, there's a lot of different levels of sadness. I think, in a sense, they all come. Their origin is in the same kind of some feeling that something's missing. That we have. And there's this sense that there's the way things should be, and then there's a contrast of the way things are. The way things are never exactly right, the way people are always hurting each other, the way you have an ideal version of how things should be, but it's never really actualized. Always something getting in the way. And I think that sense of idealism or the way things should be does come from this feeling of having some emptiness not in a confirming way, but in a yearning way, that we're just feeling like we can't get there, that our intellect and our relationships and our emotions just constantly get in our way, and that we're always losing something that we need. Yeah, in the back, gentleman in the back. Yeah.
This is a bit of a silly comment, but there's a song by Frank Zappa called Calling Me Vegetable. Yeah, it's a bit silly, a bit vulgar, and he says, call any vegetable and your chances are good, but the vegetable will respond to you.
Okay, but, then.
You know, it's a different way of thinking. You know, you can connect to a vegetable, you can connect to take a minute to be grateful for your breakfast or whatever it is.
In my first talk, I talked about taking refuge in my kitchen countertop. I don't know, some of you probably heard that. But it was this moment I had of putting my hand down and touching something and feeling a vibe of some sort that that I exchanged with it. So I think if we look at things in terms of refuge, we can kind of get to the same point of something available to us that we just have to tap into. Yeah, Phoebe. Oh. Whatever. Take turns.
Reading Chogyam Trungpa, he talks about the sadness coming from, in order to open your heart, you have to break it open. And you have to sort of, it's that pain of breaking your heart open that allows you to let others in.
Mm. Yeah, that's beautiful. It's a good way of expressing it. Phoebe.
When you first said sadness and compassion, sadness. Before you started talking about it, my first reaction was, well, of course there's sadness and compassion. That's what brings me to feel compassionate is the sadness of your suffering, you know, mm-hmm. or your trouble or whatever it is, or even, you know, just the trouble of the world. Of course, that sadness is what brings us to compassion. So that's just another, and not just my sadness, but the sadness of others.
Right. I think that it's the fact that we have our own sadness, like you were saying, that we have our own sadness, that we can really truly understand what the other person's sadness is, and we can treat it with the seriousness and honor it and respect it in an appropriate way that the other person can receive it, mm-hmm. as opposed to comforting someone or showing sympathy to someone or empathy or something like that, but which is an action that represents separateness.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is trying to...
Is it more like empathy?
It's more like empathy, yeah, it is. That's the closest word to it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's somehow, like when we talk about saving all sentient beings, it's not just us saving them, it's like saving each other by entering into a space with other mm-hmm. beings and receiving them and giving kind of as one continuous motion. That's salvation for both. One of the things... Go ahead, please. Yeah, I've heard of it. Yeah, I've never seen that.
The way that the character kind of deals with the emotions, and kind of what I got from the movie, is that there's a part about sadness, about how sometimes there's to help you connect with others. Like, don't ignore your sadness, it's there to help you reach out. But I thought that movie didn't, it kind of gave me a picture of what you were talking about.
Mm-hmm. She was referring to the movie Inside Out. I don't think I can. Can you just say it again a little bit louder so the people in this part of the room can hear it?
I was just saying the movie Inside Out is a kid's movie, but I think even the name of it, Living from the Inside Out, is kind of what it was about to me.
Living from the inside out, like bringing yourself out into the world.
Mm-hmm. Not ignoring your emotions, but using your emotions as a tool to support you in connecting.
Using your emotions to support the way you connect with others. Kind of a feeling of being real, you know, being, yeah. One of the things that I've had to do in reflecting on compassion is dealing with self-compassion. I have, in many parts of my life, had to step up and be a caregiver for mostly elderly people in my family, sick adults or elderly people. And it's been truly an exhausting activity to engage in. and one that I have found myself having a lot of mixed emotions about. And trying to understand that I can be compassionate without sacrificing myself. So I think there's a lot of expectations about what it means to be a compassionate person in terms of making other people more important than you are. And this was my issue. How can I make myself as important as somebody else? Or do I even dare make myself more important to myself than somebody else? And how do I know what to do about that? How can I act on my own behalf without feeling guilty about it? How can I take care of my own needs before another person's needs in order to be healthy? I think a lot of us face that with elderly parents or aging parents. I belong to a caregiver support group for people who are caregivers taking care of other people. And this is something that comes up a lot, trying to figure this out. What is your duty to someone that you are in a relationship of whatever sort with, that you've promised to take care of? And like when I said that I've used it to rewrite the story of my own life, in order to figure out how to make decisions I've had to make, I've had to really examine myself in a very honest way that I don't think I had ever really been forced to do before. And part of that is seeing the suffering that we have both on the surface of life and in the depths of life, and how much we really don't want to see it. You know, we don't really want to know about it. We kind of want to avoid it, I think. We can't, and yet we try to busy ourselves with other things or look on the bright side or look for the glory or the enlightenment or, you know, whatever. We want to feel good about ourselves. We want to feel like we're coping. But sometimes it all runs out and you don't have anything left of that sort of thing to bolster yourself up. So I had to really see how I got into the situation, most recently into the situation I was in, and see how I actually had a role in getting into that situation, to take responsibility for the situation and not look at myself as a victim of circumstance. I was able to do that. I was able to reconcile a lot of the uncertainty I had about what the right thing to do would be by accepting my own responsibility for the consequences of my actions, both at that time and throughout my whole life, and to see what I really would be willing to take responsibility for doing and what I could live with. So, yeah. I can't think of anything else to say about that one. Take care of yourselves. Take care of yourself first. Take the oxygen mask down first. Take care of yourself. Then take care of the person with you. Yeah. Any other thoughts you'd like to share?
So I'm I'm trying to put puzzle pieces together in my brain.
Yeah.
And I get very clearly, especially from your words today, about the gentle and compassionate way you look at things, that you take it in, you, that kind of bare awareness, not putting interpretation or stories on it. And you know, if that's the gentle taking inside, where does the force for moving forward fit into that? Like, I see that as sort of a taking in, and then in the taking in, I make choices to go out in the world, which feels like I'm initiating a force. And there's something about the gentleness that doesn't make space for force. And I'm wondering, how does force fit into being a partner of that gentle observation?
Could you hear his question? No, they couldn't hear it.
Okay.
He's addressing the issue of gentleness that could be a kind of dead end, I would say, that it's a stagnant point where you're gentle and everything is fine and you're right there.
Non-judging,
just being open. But where does action fit into a life like that? And I think it just comes out of the flow of energy that we're talking about as a system, that everything leads to something else. And I mean, you might stay in
so
that.
There's a natural,
just the way the energy is always moving and transforming, that it naturally, because of what Buddhism identifies as impermanence, it's always kind of shifting from one thing to another. Now, you may need to stay in that soft space for quite a while, but at some point, there will, without your having to design it, the system will kind of kick in with...
I think that's the important distinction that you just clarified right there. Maybe it's more organic action as opposed to ego action.
Yeah. I think you hit it. That's a really great insight. Thank you. Last chance, I guess. Okay, I guess we can have our announcements then. Thanks.